Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. This is a special edition covering our outrageous predictions for 2021. You can find those on analysis.saxo, and we even have a special landing page. Go to .saxo/OP21. So, what are the outrageous predictions? It's our yearly exercise, and we've been doing this for going on 20 years. Our yearly exercise, not in trying to create a sort of mainstream forecast or our high odds forecast for the coming year, but to consider some rather spectacular things or outrageous things that might happen and certainly have a higher likelihood of happening than the market would expect. So maybe something that should be trading as a 10 delta is actually trading as a 0.01 delta or even less. In other words, under-recognized gray swans and even semi-black swans for the future. So keep that in mind. These are not predictions for what's going to happen. These are, themes and that predictions geared for generating debate and thought on the future. So with that out of the way, we have a theme this year called The Future Is Now. And I have with me online our Chief Investment Officer, Stan Jakobsen. And then down the line, all the way down under in Australia, in fact, our strategist in Australia, Eleanor Craig. Thank you for joining so late in the day down there. And what we're going to talk about, first of all, is the title of this year's set of predictions, The Future Is Now, and how COVID-19 really has accelerated our path to the future. So take us through why we titled this year's predictions, The Future Is Now, Stain.
Yeah, so I think the main takeaway we as a team has taken from the pandemic has been the fact that through 2020, we have seen a massive acceleration of all trends that were already established. And that's all the way from, the conversation about MMT, universal basic income, but of course also this handover from monetary to fiscal policy. And we saw during the course of basically 2 weeks that everything was thrown out of the window. We went straight to MMT, straight to UBI. We went straight to the biggest balance sheet expansion ever and the highest fiscal as well. But with that came, of course, a number of unintended and intended consequences. And one of them being, of course, that we have seen that a big part of the economy was left redundant. And into this was sort of created the idea of about a K-shaped recovery, a K-shaped economy, and a K-shaped market, where some companies did extremely well on the upper sort of tier of the K, where others was left redundant. And as we started looking at the outrageous prediction, we of course realized that it's kind of difficult to compete with central bank expansion of balance sheet by almost 100% or activist policy left, right, and center. And we thought, okay, one way to do this is to actually look at how the trend makes a marginal change or even a big impact on the economy as we go forward. And that's in very short term is really what we try to do with this. We are, going beyond the sort of the market based only, but also look at what are the different trends that are emerging. And part of the reason for that, of course, also is that we think increasingly people are trading themes. We saw the green transformation theme in 2020 being the dominant one. But the futures now pretty much means that these trends has been accelerated. And as such, we need to address what is incoming in terms of new trends. And now we see, at least in our group, some pretty clear trends of what's going on. And that's really what the outrageous predictions is about.
Yeah. And you mentioned a key thing there, and that is a switch at the end of a cycle. And we have a couple of slides that you can see the link to the slide deck in the show notes. So please have a look at that. It's some pretty interesting charts in there. And one of those we argue is that we're sort of nearing the end of the line in terms of falling interest rates and the power of monetary policy and the switchover and handover to fiscal policy, where the approach is less on loans and pumping up debt and has to be more towards grants, because our debt-saturated societies cannot absorb further growth in debt. And I think what that means as well is that with, you mentioned UBI, you have a focus away from, again, lending into the economy and people simply receiving transfers. And this will help to, one hopes anyway, iron out tremendous risks from inequality. Also, when you have money printing going straight into the demand function, it could drive inflation. And then on the technology side, one of our themes we've discussed in a couple of the longer webinars we've held on this set of predictions this year is that you have these sort of political cycles that happen and you know come and go and sort of regular cycles, but technology is very much progressive, and we've somewhat combined some of these the ability of technology to bring new things that were simply not there before, and that's everything from blockchain, from energy, and then. You know how that filters through and addresses some of these risks, and also how technology has driven some of these incredible monopolies we've seen springing up. And I think that's a focus, certainly. And I'll get to you in a second, Eleanor, on this, but I think it's really key with how we divvy up the fruits of these incredibly powerful companies in a more fair way across society. But the first one, I think, is quite a headline grabber, staying the sort of Amazon buying Cypress prediction, what that one's all about and what we're trying to say with that prediction.
We're trying to say that companies today has become more powerful than government. Not only do they sit on more information about the citizens of any society, but they also have the ability to both navigate and conduct themselves in a way that gives them freedom from tax, freedom from oversight, and overall, in broader terms, regulation. And of course, Cyprus being an innocent bystander in this sort of call, because the size of the economy fits the story we want to tell. But you know, theoretically, someone like Amazon and all Facebook has so much power today that they have individual offices of lobbyism in Brussels, in K Street, in Washington. They are invited at security conferences where they normally would be only head of states being represented. And as such, we think in world history, it's never been accepted that companies are more powerful than governments. And we think there is, and we've seen early signs of this since we wrote this, in terms of the DOJ in the US bringing antitrust cases to both Facebook and now it looks like increasingly also Google. So we think this is going to be a big theme for the next 7 to 10 years. And don't forget why the one of the reasons why we like these platform economies, as the young people will call it, but what is really monopolies in an old man's version like me, is that they have monopoly, and through the monopoly has the pricing power. And it looks like there is, at least that is what the DOJ is saying, some colluding on advertising prices between these giants right now. And of course, as such, this is a negative, not only for the pricing structure, meaning that it becomes more expensive, but most importantly, and I think that is the reason why this is going to come, this call is going to come to fruition, is it is actually limiting the ability of society to be productive and innovative, because of course what happened with the monopoly power is it uses its financial strength to make the challenges disappear. So don't look at the as Cyprus part of it, but look at it as someone is more powerful than an actual jurisdiction like Cyprus as a core.
Yeah, it'd be very interesting to see how the anti or the regulatory authorities take the approach to these huge companies. But then with this advance and this march forward in technology, we have a couple of interesting graphics in our slide presentation talking about how the progress in AI, especially in automation, as well, could replace up to a couple of billion jobs in the coming, some people even saying within a decade. So already automation replacing so many factory style jobs and physical labor related jobs, but risking on the AI front is the risk there is that even white collar jobs start to be encroached upon, everything from, who knows, perhaps even teaching to some degree, but certainly paralegal type work, other more routine white collar jobs. And Ellen, that's where I wanted to bring you into the discussion. you know, if we have this risk, as we put on the one side of this, the creation of this so-called useless class, and that's actually independent of age, what are we supposed to do in a society when we need to? We have an economy that's as big and growing as ever. We have the prosperity there, but if people don't have the traditional sort of types of jobs to do, or don't have a function to provide, or some fruits of their labor to contribute, how are we supposed to divvy up the spoils? And we have a couple of predictions that sort of the sort of, you know, hinge on that development. So take us through the UBI part, and as well this idea, which I really like, of the Citizens Technology Fund.
Yeah, sure. Look, and I think it's a really interesting thing to think about because, you know, as you say, if kind of futurists or experts are to believe, the impact of artificial intelligence on labor markets will be hugely significant, and perhaps more significant than, you know, the Industrial Revolution. And it's certainly something that is going to need a policy response as we see that risk to billions of jobs. And I think we're already seeing in some sense through the pandemic, the shift towards wage replacement being that first step towards potentially this permanent shift. We know that we're going to see sort of increased income inequality only growing. That's going to continue to stifle social mobility as a lot of those entry roles or stepping stone roles are hit. And that's something that potentially, you know, down the road leads to increased political instability unless redistributive changes are made, particularly as these technology changes and automation changes throughout labor markets are going to continue to bifurcate people's reality to a further extent than is visible today. Technology brings a world of promise, but of course there's going to be losers. And as you say, how do we address some of that fallout? So one of the ways we were thinking about in terms of a way to redistribute the fruits of automation or digitization towards those who have been disrupted the most and potentially calm or quell some of those social anxieties that come with these jobs being made redundant and with the loss of income. And of course, as we've seen in recent years, this rise of populism in many ways linked to the fallout of globalization and the polarization of labor markets and the fact that, you know, the individual's importance or stake in today's economy is ever shrinking as this kind of asset poor majority is squeezed. And that continues to fuel these political and societal instabilities, which in turn turn into financial and really systemic instabilities if they are allowed to cascade further. So, you know, a way to address this is giving people a stake in that very technology that displaces them. This can either be sort of via, as we speculated, a citizens technology fund or, you know, some sort of sovereign technology fund. But there has to be a cost to the fact that these companies and this automation and disruption is leaving a trail of destruction amongst labor markets and our social fabric. And in many ways, there has to be a disruption dividend that can be reaped by the individuals that are displaced by this growing digital era.
Yeah, and so you would be funding, in a disruption dividend scenario, you'd be funding or somehow funding it via participation in, I guess it's another way around of doing UBI as opposed to simply taxation and redistribution, but actually giving ownership. I think that would be, that to me, that's the most interesting aspect of not only universal basic income, but sort of universal basic participation and what is driving the whole underlying economy.
Yeah, exactly right. And I mean, I think that goes a long way in terms of sort of quelling these social anxieties is the very fact that you, I guess, give people a stake in the technology that is making these jobs redundant. And it is something that feeds into sort of our model of this shift towards a social stability paradigm, because we really need to find a way of delivering those enhanced social safety nets and healing these inequities of our current economic model, I guess, within the constraints of our physical ecosystem and of course, the climate as well, because that this sort of technology shift is all wrapped up in the green transformation theme as well.
Yeah, and as well, I think another interesting thing we've attached to sort of, you know, if this is to become true, this prediction, what is a way it could be expressed in the market, or what are some of the consequences of it? And I think that's part of the interesting aspect of this prediction. So what are people supposed to do with their time? They've got some ownership via Citizens Technology Fund. They've got some UBI, but they aren't necessarily doing traditional sorts of labor. So we've considered what it is they're supposed to be doing with their time. And that's what I think, how it plays into the one you wrote and the cities being decimated potentially by UBI. So take us through what you think this could mean if we do get this rolled out in some form in the future.
Yeah, look, exactly. So there's going to be a lot of people, I guess, with a lot of time on their hands if we do see some of these shifts come to fruition. And we've kind of speculated that it's, I guess, the golden age of arts and crafts and leisure, with people having more time to focus on, you know, things that they actually want to focus on, whether that's for some people, of course, education, whether it's for some, you know, going back to the land, moving out of big cities. There's no longer a need to be there if you're not working in the office any longer. So why would you sort of live in these big cities? It's another thing that we're seeing, I guess, accelerated via the pandemic with this shift towards working from home, the sort of redundancy of, you know, commercial property and office space. And it's certainly something that would be accelerated if we saw one of these kind of redistributive shifts like a citizens technology fund, as people move out and potentially we see a real invigoration of communities again in rural areas as people take to leisure part-time, leisure pastimes, you know, tending the land, things like that.
Right. Great stuff. And I think we mentioned blockchain earlier as just to shift gears here a little bit, talking about blockchain and the march forward of technology. And blockchain certainly getting tremendous focus once again in 2020, merely from what, of course, is a fear of coming inflation, a fear that the monetary authorities will do whatever it means or whatever's required and successfully so to reinflate the economy and therefore driving something of limited supply like Bitcoin considerably higher again. But there are other applications of blockchain. I think we've come up with two really interesting ones in this and very, very different applications for blockchain in this year's set of predictions. And Stane, I'd like you to take us through these. First of all, fake news. How do we deal with fake news? We talk about populism and one of the, you know, one of the big drivers we've seen in recent years is the what should we call it? The atomization almost of media and the sort of choose your own reality phenomenon where you can focus in on what the internet has enabled you to sort of live in your own reality in terms of what even the basic facts are out there and how blockchain could be used to address that. And are talking about fake news being ended by blockchain. And then also the application for blockchain in so-called digital currencies. And we've got one talking about China and what the potential promises or effect of its introduction of a digital currency. So take us through on those two, your thoughts there.
Yeah, so if you look in today's world, I think the biggest deficit we have is the ability to tell truth from virtual reality or fake news, as Trump would call it. And I think that deficit is actually, you know, going through every single generation. Even us, the more senior old people, we now need to double and triple check every single fact that is given. If you have a website with a link, you have to check that website, who owns this, who's doing what. So we are, one, spending and wasting a lot of time just verifying information. But more importantly, as you said, the society has managed to create its own pockets of, let's call it relative news. And as such, it's pretty clear that something like blockchain can be the solution. First of all, it's decentralized. It's a verification process. And it's partly already established on the media group, Verizon's network. But we think that uniformly this could be adapted. And you know, interestingly enough, those who would benefit the most would be people like Facebook, who today is, you know, on a daily basis, I don't think I'm going to get sued for saying this, but they on a daily basis is putting out 80% lies and 20% truth. If they had a facility that they could use to vet all the news that come through, they may have less engagement, but they certainly will have a cleaner sort of news service. And the overall story on blockchain really for us is that we think that blockchain is one use case away from being a new modus operandi for doing things in the world. That's absolutely, take the US election. There's no reason why we should wait a month to get a verification of the results when you can have a decentralized, verified, and extremely safe election done on blockchain. You can do, as is already the case for IBM, you can have provenance of the wine that you buy in Burgundy is actually from Burgundy. You can even get the verification down to the actual sourcing on the plot of land where it comes from. So we think that blockchain over 21, but also going forward, is going to have a huge and radical impact on first news and then other areas, because it makes perfect sense. Just think about the old journalistic rule that in order to print an article, you need to have two independent sources verify the information. That is exactly the way that blockchain works. Of course, there will be censors or other news organizations that need to verify it, but certainly it's doable. So we think the, you know, dealing with that deficit, but overall becoming the first user case. The second one is also into the sphere of, in this case, not decentralized, but centralized. And that's the fact that we have, of course, seen in 2020 that the PBOC, the Chinese Central Bank, has had a trial run of having a virtual currency. We think that ultimately in 21 or 22, this will be put into operation. And if they do that, it's kind of interesting because that creates a increased transparency for the authorities at one end, but it also allows them to increase the capital flow into China through opening the capital account, because of course a digital currency and a centralized as such will have the ability of governments to control who and where the money goes to, which will mean in practicality that we as foreigners would be able to invest 24/7, 365 in China, getting our money out, which today, to be honest, is one of the major concerns our clients have, i.e. their ability to get the money off it should they invest. So that will be a real seminal event in world history for two reasons. One, because they will be the first to introduce digital currency. And secondly, because, and that's probably back to you, John, that the renminbi, in that case, if it became credible and it became online, so to speak, digital, then I think it becomes a credible alternative to the US dollar. And that could be the sort of the start of the end of the hegemony power that you see and the reserve status you see of the US dollar. And to some extent, we've seen early signs of this. I mean, the weak sees a dollar renminbi rate is partly a reflection of that, in my opinion, that people are increasingly realizing that the Chinese stock market is the second in the world. They own 60 to 70% of all IPOs the next 10 years. Whether you want it or not, if you want to perform as a fund manager, you need to be long China. And we think, interestingly enough, that technology, blockchain, digitization, and digital currency could be the way to do that.
Yeah, I think that is China's ultimate need is also to avoid being so reliant on the dollar and the weaponization of the dollar, as the U.S. China relationship has gotten extremely testy, and it's clear that they want to avoid usage of a dollar being something that's of limitating their ability to trade. So I think that the digital currency would be a very interesting approach to that. And it's actually kind of already happening. It's almost not particularly outrageous in a way, but maybe not people not recognizing what this really means, the implications of them moving forward with this. Let's look briefly at a couple that I think are really interesting this year, linked to the so-called green transformation you've talked about. There's been huge investor interest, you know, way above any actual performance from the industry, because we all know that a lot of capital and a lot of political capital is being put behind this green transformation, investing in alternative energy sources from solar to wind, et cetera. And, you know, my favorite one, I think, in this, and the least likely probably to become true, is this idea that we see some major breakthrough in fusion energy that allows us to sort of skip the green transformation via alternative energy and go straight for something that's actually what we really need. And when I say what we really need, I mean higher density energy. The history of industrialization and technological progress of our civilization has been very much linked to stepping up the density of our energy sources at every step. So from wood, with the lowest basic hydrogen content, to then coal, which has a far higher concentration than oil, and even natural gas higher still, and then nuclear fission is even more efficient in producing energy. So a couple of thoughts on that, Stain, and then why and how we link that as well to our call on silver, in that we see a potential for this sort of push, political and investment wise, to moving into green energy being limited by physical realities in the world.
Yeah, I was going to say I wanted to take that from a different angle and exactly point out the fact that, you know, if you want to do green transformation, and right now we've had the yesterday Biden announced his green cabinet, and you have the EU budget just voted through is the most green, according to Brussels at least, and China 2060's plan to be CO2 neutral. All of this means that, you know, they're going to build low density solar and wind energy production facilities around the world, which is, you know, for the first time in human evolution, we're actually going down the sophistication grading in terms of what we do. So it makes no sense. Apart from that, we and that is one of the main points we actually make in our real outlook for 21. We have a physical world today that is way too small for all of the good intention on green transformation, but not only limited to green transformation. The way to put it is that if you look at the S&P 500 now, the immaterial value of it, IP and people, is 80% of the valuation, and only 20% is physical. What we're saying is that the success and the aspiration of the green transformation put so much demand on the physical structure that is way too small. And we see that already happening through increased freight rates between China and US. On top of that, you can't even get a container to ship anything from China to Europe right now. You have the last mile delivery, of course, a critical point of being an online platform, is increasing by 50%. Companies like UPS and FedEx can't even get their hands on vans to do the actual last mile delivery. We see that in the industrial metals that they are flying, they are somewhere between, all of them double digit in the last quarter. Some of them include, like iron ore is up 45% during the last quarter. So what the world is telling us, and what the market is telling us right now, is that the physical world is too small to be able to deal with. And into that comes, of course, as you say, the most outrageous, but yet one of the ones that I have great faith in, that fusion energy comes and saves the day. Saves the day in two ways. One, because one of the obstacles and challenges to our productivity and the flattening productivity curve that we've had over the last decade comes from the fact that energy needs to be cheaper to create the next level of development. Take computer, quantum computers, take the ability of vertical farming, desalination of water, which of course is, in terms of the poor countries of the world, is the number one concern. Imagine you have energy at 1/10, 100, 1/1000 of the price that we have today. The abundance of that will create the biggest productivity and human evolution that we ever seen in history. And the interesting part, of course, being that MIT in their project with the fusion energy in June 21 will build the first facility to do that live. And they say that by 2025, they will have, at least in a laboratory form, this fusion energy under control. And personally, for me, 2020 has been, you know, a negative year. But the one upside that we had is that science stepped up in a big way. If anyone has told me that 12 months after the first breakout that we saw in China, that we will have a vaccine in place to start the rolling out of those exact same vaccine, I think that would have been a very, very big concern. But maybe throw the question over to Eleanor as well, because, of course, Australia being one of these resource countries, do you see any of these physical constraints? I noticed that, of course, the curtailing of the export of coal has created problems for China, which is political, but it seems like that this focus on the mining sector is becoming a big theme. What do you see, Eleanor?
Yeah, of course. So the example you've pointed out, I guess it's a great example of potentially China's strategy to keep these middle powers in check is maybe going to backfire. Australia potentially going to be a case in point there. You know, it's not just the restrictions on coal, but also iron ore, LNG prices as well have taken off too, because the shortage of coal in China has increased gas demand. So we've seen that Aussie LNG export revenues have increased, and it's really alongside iron ore, obviously, and it's really outweighing the hit to these smaller export industries like the agricultural commodities, barley or wine or whatsoever, which have seen these humongous tariffs put in place. And I guess the net effect is contributing to a boost in export revenues at this stage. Of course, that will subside somewhat as iron ore prices normalize. But I guess shot in the foot does seem to encapsulate some of China's actions in that respect. But yeah, I mean, in terms of other areas, I think where we are seeing maybe this capacity or this shift within our physical constraints also come within the rare earth sector in Australia. But we've also seen uranium stocks as well. It's really across the whole commodity spectrum, you know, because we just need a ton more of these commodities in order to deliver this green shift. You know, copper's been wrapped up in that as well. And if we do follow the scenario pathways which have been set out in concert with the IPCC in terms of needing to come in under 1.5 degrees centigrade of global warming above pre-industrial levels by 2050, you know, that's going to lead to huge deficits within many commodity markets because there's been a huge amount of structural underinvestment throughout the years gone. That's certainly going to, I guess, benefit Australia in that respect.
Yeah, and certainly Australia sits in a weird place relative to other, you know, developed markets with its economy benefiting so much from, you know, quote unquote, dirty sources of energy and dirty, very high energy intensive industries like steel making, et cetera, via its iron ore exports. And you've also run into the physical limits side of things with the whole power catastrophe a couple of years back where there was insufficient power being provided and they had to install Tesla batteries to sort of buffer the system at times. So I think Australia is a very interesting contact point in almost all of our themes really for this year's set of outrageous predictions. And I want to close out, and I think this is one of the most interesting ones. I think it really addresses a key theme as well. And I would link it almost as well to the Germany bailing out France outrageous prediction. And that's our prediction that, or outrageous prediction that a successful COVID-19 vaccine could actually start to see an unwinding of some of the credit excesses we've seen in recent years. So Steen, take us through that, this whole idea of you can have endless liquidity, but in the end, don't you need solvency?
Yeah, and that's going to be 21's big story because as Eleanor eloquently explained, if you have a physical world that is too small for the online world and for the demand from the green transformation, we're inevitably going to see pressure points coming from high interest rates and through high inflation. And that high inflation, which no one seems to think will happen, will release a change in the central bank thinking from one where they want it to run wild to one where they want to contain it. And so I think one of the real surprises of 21 could be the fact that Fed and others would be forced to at least move from a dovish stance to a neutral and ultimately to a tightening stance. And in that process, of course, we run into this issue of solvency. So, you know, the banking system in Europe, despite the fact that we have all-time high in stock market valuation, is still just barely off its low, all-time low. The non-performing loans at the banks is perceived and accounted in a way which is very, very, very wrong. I mean, the real number is much bigger, but governments, including the Scandinavian ones, have, of course, issued the guarantee that no one should lose out on this pandemic, which is a blanco check to support these economies. But imagine a world where growth is coming back, inflation is emerging, and interest rates starts to rise. That will leave open for everyone to see which company are solvent and which one are insolvent. And in that story, we think that France, which is during this pandemic, has been one of the hardest hit on an economic and on the ground, moving their private debt to GDP to in excess of 140%. Just for reference, this is significantly higher than both Greece and Italy. which of course translates directly into a risk for the banking system in France. And if the French banking system is under pressure, so will the German. The German banks are not exactly star performers, despite being in a very rich and very affluent country. But Germany would ultimately have to bail them out. So what we're really saying is that, you know, in 21, we could theoretically see a European banking union through the back door, maybe not agreed by the full EU council, but effectively being that, exactly because the two most important economies, France and Germany's banking sector, will be unable to deal with the insolvencies, most likely the catalyst being the French economy, but by virtue of a spillover, the Germans would see in their own self-interest to not bail them out directly, but of course issue what we see these days as a guarantee for the banking system that encapsulates this solvency risk. But solvency risk, in our opinion, is one of the major themes and one of the risks that you in 21 will need to deal with.
All right. Thanks for that, Stane. And thank you so much, Eleanor, for joining from down under at this late hour for you.
Great to be here.
And I think as you can hear from this set of outrageous predictions and what COVID-19 has set in motion with accelerating our path towards the future, we really think there 2021 could be equally as outrageous in many ways as 2020. So stay tuned for that. Again, you can see the full set of predictions, the full PDF, and some great cartoon illustrations from our artist on goto.saxo/OP21 for today. Thank you so much for joining, and stay tuned, of course, for further daily Saxo Market Call podcasts and a couple of more special editions we have up for you in the coming days here to entertain you over the holidays. From the team, thanks very much, and we'll be back soon.